It's our golden birthday, episode 200 of the 200 Churches podcast.
And it doesn't actually take many praying people to make a major difference in a town or city or village. It takes a core of committed, prayerful, wise people, and actually things can change. I've seen it done, and it's very, very exciting when it happens. I would say if God has given you 10, 15, 20 people, then hallelujah, we can do things with people at that number. If God has given you somewhere between 50 and 100, tremendous. There are things that groups like that can do, and then they need to break down as well for other purposes into smaller groups.
Welcome to the 200 Churches podcast, where every Wednesday we produce a fresh episode of ministry encouragement for pastors of small churches. Now here are two guys who, like you, serve in the trenches of small church ministry.
The Boardwalk and Park Place of ministry. Podcasts, Jeff and Johnny.
This is the 200 Churches podcast. My name is Jeff Cady, and I'm here with my podcast partner, formerly long-haired, now moderate length,
Johnny Craig.
Johnny, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm 200, man.
Yes.
Episode 200, and we are recording this introduction to episode 200,
mm-hmm.
which itself was recorded a fair amount of time ago.
Yeah.
But we're recording it today, the day that it's going to go out tonight.
Yeah.
So
wanted this to be fresh, like a hot bun from the oven.
Get close to your speaker or your earbuds and you could probably smell our breath.
Oh, what a horrible thing.
It is horrible. Hey, today, finally, we get to reveal our guest for episode 200.
Yes.
You know, we thought we would have liked to get this person or that person, but then we decided we would just ask Dr. N.T. Wright.
Yeah.
The most right reverend. The former Bishop of Durham.
Yes.
Over there across the pond in the U.K. and a prolific
New Testament
scholar and author.
Look, I've done it before. I'm going to do it again. It's not that I'm dumping on Rick Warren. I'm just saying I'm really glad Rick Warren was too busy for small churches so that we could talk to the real deal, N.T. Wright.
I hope that our listeners would please note that I was gracious in my introductory remarks. Of course, we hope Rick is able to come on.
Sure.
But when we had to put N.T. Wright in his place, in Rick's place.
I call that an upgrade. That's what I call.
I think Rick calls that an upgrade.
an upgrade.
Let's all just be humble about it.
N.T. Wright.
Rick is nothing if not humble.
Oh,
so,
my goodness.
No, yeah, we're very, very, very thankful.
Yes.
You know, you and I, when we got on the line with him, it was about 2 or 3 minutes into the call, and you and I were looking at each other like, how are we going to handle this conversation?
Oh, my goodness.
What in the world? We didn't know. How are we going to do this? What are we going to say? What are we going to ask?
You know, people say I talk fast. I think N.T. Wright puts me to shame.
Well, he's just this, and you're going to hear it in just a second, as soon as we get done with our mumbo jumbo here.
Yeah.
This guy, it's just this constant flow, this stream of consciousness, this stream of scholarship and theological insight.
He's never at a loss for a thought.
It's wonderful. And the best thing, here's the best thing from my perspective for this podcast, is that we got to get him to talk about small church ministry.
Yeah.
And small church pastors, and what you're going to hear from Tom Wright, Dr. N.T. Wright, is very, I thought, so encouraging to pastors of normal-sized churches.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, stick around after. Don't turn this off when the interview's done. We got a special kind of a gift, kind of an offer for you, our listeners. It's a special offer with N.T. Wright and special to 200 churches for you small church pastors. So stick around after our conversation with N.T. Wright, and we'll be talking about that. Here it is, our conversation with the one, the only, N.T. Wright.
It's great to have you, Professor N.T. Wright. It's good to have you on our podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Now, Dr. Wright, I can't call you N.T. this whole time. Am I allowed to call you Tom?
Yes, of course. Yes, people do. That's fine.
Wonderful.
That might blow Johnny's head up and make it
a little bit,
big if he calls you Tom.
Yeah, he'll have to handle that.
This is a serious question now. Do you get a lot? I mean, you come, maybe in England too, but you come to the United States and your books are very popular within the church here in the United States. You're quite the figure. Do you get a lot of people being kind of fanboys and fangirls? Does that, you know, like coming up and wanting selfies?
Only a very, very little bit. Yeah, there's a little bit of that when I come to America, but I mean, that's kind of trivial surface noise. Here in St. Andrews, where I live in Scotland, not in England, by the way, I'm just a professor walking down the street, and from time to time, students will come up and ask me questions, but there's no, I'm not aware of anything like what you describe.
Okay, sure. Well, that's probably good then. Keep you humble.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to seminary here, you hear about N.T. Wright.
Yes.
You know,
oh, right.
You read the books, you hear the arguments, and your perspective on things. So very enjoyable. I really enjoyed your book, Surprised by Hope, in one of the courses that I took, and just gave me some new appreciation.
Great, great. I get more emails and phone calls and messages about Surprised by Hope than about all my other books put together. It just, for some reason, it seems to have struck a chord, I think particularly in America.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of Americans grow up simply with heaven and hell as their ultimate parameters, as it were, and to discover that the Bible actually doesn't go on about heaven and hell, but goes on about new creation in which heaven and earth will be joined together in a new reality. This is just totally new to people, and they gaze at me as though I'm, you know, a man from Mars or something. And then when you start looking at the Bible and seeing, yep, this is how it works out, and it changes everything in terms of how you think about mission, how you think about spirituality, which is, of course, what all that book's about. And in a sense, the present book, The Day the Revolution Began, the book has just come out yesterday, this is the necessary backup for that, because without the cross and the achievement of the cross, then the resurrection and the new creation wouldn't be happening.
Sure. So what led you to write this, the book, The Day the Revolution Began? I mean, it's not a book on atonement theories necessarily. So what led you to it?
Yeah, I suppose when I was starting work on it, I thought it was going to be about atonement theory, but atonement is such a big topic and would require so many other things, like to look at Jesus' resurrection and ascension as well and see how the whole thing works together. So I decided to try to focus on what the New Testament really seems to be insisting, namely that by the evening of Good Friday when Jesus died, the world really was a different place. And nobody knew that except God. But when Jesus rose from the dead, that unveiled the fact that on Good Friday, the revolution had begun. And something that the dark powers had been defeated, if you like. And so I was, ever since I worked on the resurrection, I was very keen to come back, as it were, and look at the cross. And obviously, because I've written about different aspects of the New Testament, I've written about the cross from many different angles, many different times over the last 30 or 40 years. But I'd never actually sat down and pulled it all together. And when I did, and I started doing this with some lectures here in St. Andrews a couple of years ago, I was quite shocked by what I was finding in terms of what other people had said, in terms of theories that were advanced, in terms of people reading this text this way and that text that way, people forgetting about the fact that the Gospels, for instance, are all about the kingdom of God, with the cross as the climax of the inauguration of the kingdom. And that's just often ignored in churches and in theology, etc. So I thought, my goodness, we have a problem here to unscramble this and put it all back together the way that the New Testament actually does. So that's what I've been trying to do.
Why do you think that this Surprised by Hope, and do you think that your crucifixion book here is going to be similar? Do you think it's going to generate the same interest?
That would be very nice, because I do want to get people thinking about these things, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think the point is, when you change the vision of what God's ultimate future purposes are, then you are bound to ask the question differently as to how we get from where we are as sinful human beings into that final purpose. So that if you think that God's final purpose is that good people go to heaven, and heaven is a sort of a disembodied reality up in the sky somewhere or in a different sphere entirely, and if you think that goodness just means have I behaved myself, and if I haven't, how do I get out of that problem, then you are bound to look at everything to do with the gospel, with the cross, with the kingdom of God, completely differently. Whereas if you say, no, God's purposes are to bring heaven and earth together and for humans to have an active role within that as the royal priesthood, which is what Revelation particularly says, and that's deeply rooted in the Old Testament, then the question doesn't become, how does the fact that I'm a sinner somehow not stop me getting into heaven, but how does the fact that I have been an idolater and sinned and all the rest of it, how does God deal with that in order to reconstitute me as part of his royal priesthood, to be part of his new creation project? And so everything you then say about incarnation, atonement, etc., comes out differently as a result. And all of that, of course, comes straight out of the New Testament. And this isn't another set of ideas culled from somewhere else. And part of my problem is that so much Western Christianity has taken elements of the New Testament, but has fed them into a narrative which is, at best, a sub-biblical narrative. This business of, I'm a sinner, so how do I get to heaven? If you ask the question like that, you will be telling a story which isn't quite the story that the Bible tells. And it's only when you get the story right that the different bits mean what they're meant to mean within that story.
So is this the first book that you've released since your gigantic Paul volume?
No. You haven't been paying attention.
Apparently.
No, there was a book last year on a history of Pauline, modern Pauline interpretation, called Paul and His Recent Interpreters. And that came out, I'm just checking here, 2015, yes.
Okay.
And there was a little book called The Paul Debate that came out at the same time from Baylor University Press, just trying to respond to some initial criticisms of that book. Then I have a book which came out earlier this year, but it's only in the UK so far, though people in America could get it on amazon.co.uk, which is called God in Public, which is some essays and lectures that I did on, well, as the title says, how do we do God in the public space?
That
which
sounds
I think
very
is quite
interesting.
Important, actually. Yeah, I'm surprised my American publishers haven't picked it up yet. Maybe they will one day. So, yeah, those are, in a way, smaller things. Well, Paul and His Recent Interpreters is about 400 pages, and that's a kind of a romp through Pauline scholarship in the last 60 or 70 years. And I think students are going to find that, I hope, helpful. But so this is the first book in the sort of, in my sort of popular theology series. Not that it is an official series, it just seems to be happening that way.
Have you slowed down at all in the last 20 years?
Yeah, I sleep a bit more now than I used to. I think so. I'm frustrated with my body doesn't do the things it used to. Like, I used to be able to climb mountains more easily, and it's harder work these days than it used to be. So there are a few things like that.
On our podcast, I always try to bring things around to small church pastors. And, you know, we talk to people that accomplish a lot of great things. And somehow I want to put the cookies on the bottom shelf, so to speak. And when you were the Bishop of Durham, you oversaw how many different churches in the UK?
There were 250 parishes, more or less, in the diocese. Now, it depends how you count them, because from time to time with the smaller parishes, we would try to amalgamate them and bring them together. But it was basically 250 or so ecclesial communities spread over that bit of the northeast of England.
And how much involvement did you have with the... Now, did you call them pastors of those parishes?
Well, they would either be vicars or rectors.
Okay.
Those are traditional Anglican terms. But, the senior pastor, the minister, whatever. But, the parish priest. My job was basically to be a pastor to them.
Okay.
Which is not easy, but because I had lots of other things to do as well, as a bishop you have a national role and actually an international role sometimes, and I was called upon to do quite a bunch of things nationally and internationally, but I would always come back to home base to be there for those folk.
And what were some of the things there in the UK that the rectors and
the vicars
were dealing with? I mean, what were some of their struggles and frustrations that you dealt with?
Yeah, I think the biggest one in the northeast of England in general would be a shrinking population and, in consequence, or going with that, decline in money. the bit that I was dealing with, Old County Durham, between the River Tyne and the River Tees, is sort of equivalent to the Rust Belt in parts of your country, that we used to have a very flourishing shipbuilding industry. That's all gone. We used to have a very flourishing coal mining industry. That was all shut down by Maggie Thatcher. There used to be much more thriving farm culture, particularly in the inland part of the diocese, and there is still quite a lot of farming, but they have had foot and mouth disease, and successive governments have not handled farming and how it works that well. There used to be a very thriving fishing industry up the coast, but because of European regulations, a lot of that has dwindled. So if you imagine what that does to one community after another after another, a lot of young people growing up in these areas, they look around and they say, well, there's nothing here for me. So either they just shrink their ambitions, and there's a lot of actually third-generation unemployment. You know, where grandfather lost his job in the 1950s, the father has never worked, the son in his 20s now has never worked and does not expect ever to work. And that is just demoralizing for the whole community. And it means that there's a lot of petty crime, a lot of alcohol abuse, a lot of teenage pregnancies, and all the usual signs of social deprivation. So any young people who've got a bit of oomph and want to get on, they leave and they go south. They go to York, or they go to Birmingham, or in particular, they go to London. And so London thrives, and the Northeast and many other parts, it's not just the Northeast, many other parts of the country, are struggling with the people that remain. So many of the pastors of the congregations that I was ministering to would be looking at a church group of 100 to 200, or maybe 50 to 100 on a Sunday morning, of whom maybe at least half would be retired. Quite a lot of them would be widows, because in the traditional heavy industries, the men tended to die young, particularly in coal mining. They got respiratory diseases and so on. And so there's not much money. Sometimes the clergy were the easily the highest paid people in the congregation, and clergy do not earn big salaries at all. In fact, the opposite is the truth. So that then it's not easy to get new things going, to start energetic programs. So a lot of them, they feel they're just doing maintenance, and they wish they could do some mission as well. And some of them are doing a great job at that, but it's really tough. So the people and the money, and also I think in the Church of England as a whole, there are some anxieties about what direction the church is going, what does it mean to be part of a worldwide Anglican communion, which has some very lively churches in the third world and some very confused churches in the first world, and so on and so on. So that in the middle of that, there were some real heroes and some real heroines who I honor and value and respect, and I still pray for them, who were just working their hearts out and working their socks off day by day and week by week to be with people, to pray with people, to make stuff happen on the ground. So it's tough. It's tough, but there are good things happening.
There's a whole ocean between us, but I don't think that the situation you've described is so unlike what a lot of pastors who are listening face. You know, you brought up the Rust Belt.
I'm sure that's so, yeah.
Yeah, the Rust Belt. I think rural America is struggling in a lot of ways with drugs here in Iowa, where we're from. You know, everybody's
right.
Meth is kind of the big thing. And there's a brain drain, like what you described, of young people kind of getting out or you know, sticking around but thinking that, you know, the church has nothing to offer.
Yes, exactly. And I think there are communities, many of them actually in the northeast of England, where the church has been able to do new things, and then people see and are amazed and say, oh my goodness, didn't know this could happen. And there are some local authorities, I think of Gateshead, for instance, which is on the south side of the River Tyne, opposite Newcastle. And the authorities, the civic authorities in Gateshead, have got a very good relationship with the church, because they know that the churches are in some of the toughest areas of their patch, where it's very hard for them as civic leaders to make anything happen or to deal with the social deprivation. But the churches are on the front line, and it's not the right image, but we used to say that in the church we punch above our weight. You know, there may not be very many of us, but we actually, we get stuff done. We work with people, as you say, with drug rehab or youth unemployment or whatever it is.
Is this some of, I mean, do you touch on some of this in that book that you mentioned, God in Public?
There's a bit. That's sort of rumbling along in the background. I mean, there are pieces in God in Public on, for instance, Where Was God in the War on Terror? Hmm. That started off as a lecture which I gave in Durham Cathedral, actually, to a largely student audience who were asking that question in 2004, 5, 6.
Yeah.
And I got some flack for it, actually, from American friends, because I was trying to name and shame some of the forces that I saw in Britain and America, which were just charging off into this thing called the War on Terror, as though it was a war against evil with a capital E, without actually thinking theologically, let alone, you know, practically, about what was actually going to happen as a result. So that, and then stuff about the kingdom of God and what that looks like on the street. So yes, I do get into some of the practicalities. I haven't actually got a copy of that book in front of me at the moment. As I came through to a different room to try to do the Skype. But still, so yes, it is quite practical. And obviously my time as Bishop of Durham, I was working in Parliament because I was a member of the House of Lords through that period. And though I couldn't be there more than maybe 3 days a month, it's still quite important to be there to be both a voice for the northeast of England, because there aren't very many other people in the House of Lords from the northeast of England, but also a voice for God at the table. And we've still got that in the UK, however odd it seems to us as well as to you. And as long as that's there, then, you know, the bishops ought to be using it.
Now, were you ever involved in the Prime Minister's questions?
No, that's in the House of Commons.
Oh, of course, the House of Commons.
There is the equivalent in the House of Lords. Every day there is a question time for 40 minutes at the start of business in the House of Lords, and then people put down questions to ask to the different government spokesmen in the House of Lords. And yeah, I used to get involved in that on a variety of topics.
So in these small parishes, these pastors are dealing, you probably have guys, you don't have women leading churches, correct?
Absolutely, yes, we do.
Oh, you
sure.
do? Okay,
sure.
So you have men and women that are maybe even second or third generation pastors in a society that's economically depressed, and you know, a region that's so depressed. So, in other words, their parents have been working in these churches when the society was similar.
It's more, these are people who have felt called by God to be ordained, to preach the gospel, to work with the local communities at whatever level, to get involved, there's a strong sense in the Church of England still that what we're about is the kingdom of God, and the kingdom of God is about doing all the things that it says in the Sermon on the Mount, about feeding the hungry, about housing the homeless, about being weeping with those who weep, about having a passion for justice, about seeking peace and trying to make peace. And what does that look like on the street? And the church is out there trying to do it, and discovering, of course, that the way you do it is through telling people about Jesus. But they're more likely to listen to what you say about Jesus if they can see that the community which you're building around this message actually makes sense as a human community and is actually functioning as one of my favorite moments when I was in one of the really run-down parishes, and I was doing a confirmation service, and a young adult, I think she was in her 30s, she was being confirmed, and I asked her why what she'd found was different since she'd become part of the church and had come to faith. And she said, it's like having a great big second family. And then she said to me, was I supposed to say that? And I said, yeah, that's wonderful, because that means that this church is a real church. This is a community where the word family means the people who live down the street who look out for you and who will be there to help when they're needed. And if the church is perceived to be and felt to be that sort of a community, then hallelujah, this is a real church.
I think Paul even had a perspective like that, didn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. No, I mean, when Paul talks about love, I think we often misunderstand him. Love, in the New Testament terms, is very, very practical. Love is primarily something you do, and you feel it as you do it, but it is about do, as First John says. What good does it, or James says, what good does it say, have a good time, have a nice day, if you're not actually doing what the people need?
You're involved in this new thing called NT Right Online.
This is a new venture which Dave Seamoth and I have been working on. I mean, David does most of the hard work, to be honest, because I simply sit in my room and talk to a camera, which is quite interesting for two or three days. But then it all gets edited and framed, and then the written materials, the course materials, and the running of the website and so on. So David's basically doing all that stuff. But the idea was that I was doing too much dashing around. I'm still doing a bit too much dashing around because I get a lot of interesting invitations, and I can't say no to all of them, though I try to say no to as many as I can. And David said to me, look, the great thing about these online courses is that people can log on and take the course at their own pace, but they get to see you and hear you speak and to feed in questions through him as well, which is fantastic, so that I don't have to move from home to do that.
And I've looked at some of those courses online, and you're sitting in your office, and
yes,
you're sharing this teaching, and this,
yes,
is, so this has not taken up a ton of your time, practically speaking.
Not a ton, no. I mean, it's two or three days of intensive filming, two or three times a year.
Okay, and how much prep do you have to do? Like, you did a course on Romans. And it took you a couple of days to film it. How much prep did you have to do for that?
I did about two or three days preparation for that, really in order to see how to boil down the segments to a maximum of 20 minutes, because that's what they are. Because, you know, I've lectured on Romans and written on Romans most of my adult life, but the trouble is you start talking about almost any verse in Romans, and before you know what's happened, the clock has gone around at least an hour. So trying to break it down into segments of quarter of an hour, 20 minutes each, was the real slog. Some of the stuff that I've done is material that I've known well through lecturing and teaching and writing. Some of it is stuff that I'm on the edge of that I want to develop. That'll take a little bit longer. So it is some preparation, not a huge amount, because the point is not... These are not meant to be cutting-edge academic presentations. These are not like conference presentations at the Society of Biblical Literature with all the footnotes and all the academic references. These are for everybody, for anyone who wants to tune in and learn about Ephesians or Romans or the meaning of the cross or whatever it is.
Is your goal to do all of the New Testament books?
We haven't said that, and that isn't currently the goal, no. We'll see how it goes. I think we have a few more things that we want to do, and then we've, you know, quite soon we will have a fairly solid portfolio, and it may be, I don't know, we haven't really discussed too much down the road yet, but it may be that what we'll do is kind of develop and market that portfolio once we've got a few more courses on the rack, as it were, and see how that goes, and then see if we want to do more. I don't know. I think David and I are both open-ended on that at the moment.
Well, we're going to talk. We're going to continue our conversation with David to be able to be the best partners we can be with both the Wisconsin Center, but particularly with NT Wright Online, because this is something that really, it can really help pastors of small churches, and it can help help them as they lead their Bible studies within their churches. It could help them personally, but it also helps them to pastor and minister and disciple the people in their church. So NT Wright Online, I mean, literally bringing you right into the living rooms and into the middle of the small groups.
That could
be a real powerful thing. And what we really like about it is that the Wisconsin Center for Christian Study, it's a nonprofit, and this is something that's done for ministry. And that's basically what 200 Churches is. We don't sell anything right now. We've never sold anything. And we can partner with NT Wright Online to really help get this kind of material.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And, I mean, obviously there are costs involved, and which is why there has to be a cost for the user. In fact, I am not an administrator. I'm not an organizer. I'm just a theologian and a preacher sort of thing. So I'm very grateful that David and the little team that he has working with him, they basically do all that. And so we just agree what I'm going to talk about, and then I talk about it.
Well, you're just a theologian and a preacher, and you wrote a few
books.
So you can't organize anything except for your thoughts and put it down. So I want to take a shift right now, Tom, just for a few minutes. And I want your opinion on this phenomenon within, and it's probably more prevalent in the United States for sure. But it's this idea that with the media now and with us to be able to know everything and see everything, pastors in the ministry world, they get exposed to a lot of the larger congregations, a lot of the mega churches, and a lot of those mega church leaders and their teachings and their networks. And many, many, many small church pastors can easily get discouraged that they're in a church of 50 or 70 or 30 or 100, and that their church hasn't ballooned to 5,000 or it hasn't ballooned to 1,000. So I guess what we're trying to do is we're really trying to affirm and encourage the kingdom impact of small congregations, you know, dotted throughout the landscape, and that not every leader, not every pastor is going to be the pastor of 1,000 or 2,000.
And what are
some of your thoughts on some of that?
Yeah, it's a curious thing, isn't it? Because we don't have very many churches in the UK of over, say, 500 members. There are a few, and there are a few within the newer free churches. There are a few Anglican churches that would be sort of between 500 and 2,000 or so. I don't think you get many that are many more than that. The problem that you mentioned isn't one that most people in the UK are even aware of. They haven't actually seen it coming down the road at them. But obviously, if you're in a culture where there are these enormous churches, and when somebody is preaching on Sunday, maybe to three different services, and each time there's another 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000, I should say, I once preached at Willow Creek, so I know about that. 7,000 on the Saturday night, another 7,000 at 9 o'clock on the Sunday morning, another 7,000 at 11 o'clock on the Sunday morning, and actually, that's just a totally, totally different experience. It's more like doing television or something, because as a pastor and a preacher, I like to establish eye contact with as many of the congregation as I can. And if you've got 200 or 300 in an ordinary sized church, you can do that. But if there's thousands, then none of them are looking at you. They're looking at the image of you, which is on a big screen up behind you somewhere. And if you want to look at them, you have to find where the camera is and eyeball the camera, which is a very artificial exercise. There's all sorts of things which just feel different. But, I mean, in a sense, that's the surface of it. But underneath that is, I think, the sense which we all have in the Western world, that bigger is better. And just that you Americans do it even more than the rest of us do. I mean, I think when we go back to the Gospels and you see that Jesus calling 12 disciples, and then there's the call of the 70, and I've heard people who work in large churches say that actually every Christian needs to be, ideally, in a group somewhere between 10 and 15 in size for local fellowship and prayer together, etc., and that every Christian ideally ought to be in a grouping that is somewhere between 50 and 100 in size, composed of 4 or 5 or 6 of those smaller groups, or 7. In other words, something like 12 and something like 70. These are healthy numbers. And something about the human dynamics are that people work well in those groups. Now, that's not to say there's anything wrong with having a church with 20,000 members. It's just that what you have to do through presumably your assistant pastors and team leaders and people is to make sure that the people who turn up on a Sunday morning, whenever it is, are also being steered into smaller groups, whether it's groups of 70 that might meet from time to time, or groups of somewhere between, as I say, 10 and 15 that meet from time to time, so that they can actually have eyeball-to-eyeball contact. And for the 70, that's more about doing projects in the community. With a group of 70, you can actually get something going in a neighborhood, whatever the particular needs are, whether there's lonely old people, whether there's lots of kids on the street, whatever it may be. And there's sort of economies of scale. There are some things you can do really, really well with a couple of hundred, but then that's too big and clunky for some of the other tasks. So I would say, if God has given you 10, 15, 20 people, then hallelujah, we can do things with people at that number. If God has given you somewhere between 50 and 100, tremendous. There are things that groups like that can do, and then they need to break down as well for other purposes into the smaller groups, and so on up the scale. But in particular, when we were in Durham, granted that most of our 250 parishes probably had somewhere between 50 and 150 active members, sort of regularly contributing, regularly, more or less regularly turning up, We talked a lot about Jesus' parables in Mark 4, about sowing seeds. In fact, the diocesan strategy that we developed was called Growing the Kingdom. And it was about planting seeds, and the seeds which look small, but which in fact may grow into plants which will surprise you. And some may stay as small plants, and some may suddenly go shooting off in other directions, and that's great too. But the point is to sow, to plant and water, to be faithful, and depending on the ground, on the type of seed, etc., God will do what God will do. But as I say, in the northeast of England, it was no surprise that there weren't many large churches, because there weren't many large anythings, because, as I say, people with any oomph and energy were getting up and leaving and going somewhere else where there were jobs and money and so on. So it wasn't just the church, it was the Women's Institute, it was the golf club. It was, so the church was in there in the middle of that deprived society with everybody else, but being there for everybody else. And it doesn't actually take many praying people to make a major difference in a town or city or village. It takes a core of committed, prayerful, wise people, and actually things can change. I've seen it done, and it's very, very exciting when it happens.
From a biblical perspective, Tom, theologically, let's bring the New Testament into this a little bit. And again, I want to speak to the 20 and 30-something leaders that are – now, we have most of our listeners come from, of course, United States, Canada, Australia, and the U.K. That's where the majority of them are from. For the 20 or 30-somethings that are starstruck on creating a platform for themselves and creating a ministry that is known and growing their church, I mean, this is kind of the ministry culture we live in. You've just described from a very practical standpoint, you know, how ministry happens, which that was a great answer, by the way. But man, I'll bring biblically, where does the New Testament speak into some of what you just shared? You talked about the 70 and the 12. Where does Paul speak into it?
And the parables of the sower and so on, the seed and the sower. And then, I mean, again, the Acts of the Apostles. Here are these guys going out in pairs, or Paul going by himself into the lion's den in Athens or whatever, and there's just a few of them. But this is why Paul talks about the power of the gospel, that it certainly isn't because he and a bunch of folk are turning up in Corinth or somewhere and looking spectacular and everyone saying, oh, wow, aren't these people amazing? Precisely the opposite. They look bedraggled and they've been shipwrecked and stoned and beaten up, but they're coming into town and talking about Jesus and stuff happens. Now, you know, that's sometimes how God works today, and sometimes we do need a bigger organization. Depends entirely what the particular vocation is. But I think one of the interesting things that's happened in the UK over the last generation is that a lot of people coming forward for ordained ministry and for full-time ministry are actually older. They are not people who have signed on at the age of 20 for this. They've done something else. Often they've had families, they've been in a job, and age 40 or 45 or 50 or something, they say, actually, I think God is now calling me. And some of the most exciting new ministries that I was commissioning and ordaining were people bringing skills from other walks of life into the church. And one of the good things about that was that, in a sense, for some of them, they had nothing to prove. They'd already done what they were going to do in another sphere, but God had been nudging them on the elbow for some years, and finally they give in and say, okay, I'm going to come and do this now. And then they really want to give themselves to this community, this, whether it's 10 people showing up in church or whether it's 300 people. They just want to work with this community to teach them to pray, to read their Bibles, to love the Lord, to serve the Lord in whatever their calling is. But I think at the same time, God can and does use what you might call youthful ambition, when people with youthful energy and drive want to come in and they want to feel that they're in some ways a success. But the way that God uses that is always going to have the cross at the heart of it, because if it's just me charging off doing my thing, then pretty soon I'm going to trip over my own feet and make some major mistakes, and we'll have some hard lessons to learn. And ideally, one is prepared in seminary and so on, and if you work as an assistant to somebody who's a wise teacher when you're starting out as a pastor, you realize that there are many lessons of humility to be learned, and that if you don't learn them the easy way, God will make you learn them the hard way, and that's not always a pretty sight. So I wouldn't discount the youthful energy and ambition and enthusiasm, but I would say, okay, let's put that within a gospel-shaped, cross-shaped framework and actually see what that looks like when somebody is zealous for the Lord but realizes that this is about they have to die in order that the work may live. They have to be crucified with Christ so that then Christ will live in them, and so on. And very much Galatians 2, 19 and 20, it seems to me, though that Paul isn't there talking about the nature of ministry, but I think it actually applies very strongly to that.
That's really interesting, and I like what you said, and it made me wonder a question of biography for you. You know, you've been in ministry. You're kind of a figure, like we talked about. You know, of ministry and of theology. Where did you get started, and at what age? And did you have, like what you just described, did you have that wise teacher? I get to sit across from Jeff, so obviously I have my wise teacher right here. But you know, is that, what's your story of ministry?
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up in a church-going family. As I said, one of my grandfathers was a parish priest and an archdeacon, actually. And so I had role models around me. And from a very early age, I think it was about seven or something, I'm not sure exactly when, I just knew. It wasn't a question of shall I, shan't I. I just knew sooner or later this is what I had to do to go into ministry, to be a preacher, to lead worship, etc. I always assumed for the next 10 or more years that this would mean I would be, as it were, an ordinary parish priest running an ordinary Christian community. This was before I discovered theology, or before theology discovered me, because I had loved the Bible through my teens. I was very well taught in Scripture Union boys camps and in various other contexts. And so I was really excited by the Bible through my teens. And then when I was studying in Oxford and was doing philosophy and history and then theology, I was just so knocked out by it. And I thought, if only I could actually spend all my life doing this, and realized bit by bit that it was possible, though it's difficult, to combine an academic and a pastoral, well, I don't like the word career, but an academic and pastoral vocation. But that has been difficult because the way that the church currently organizes itself, there's a huge amount of administration to do, and whichever job you're doing, doing the other one as well, pastoral and theological, is very difficult. There just aren't enough hours in the day. It used to be possible when clergy had less administration to do and theologians had less to do, but it's harder now. So I've tended to bounce to and fro between the two, and at the moment I'm in the academic bit, but obviously I've done quite a long time in the pastoral bit, but I've always tried to combine them. So and for me, so then I went straight off after undergraduate work. I went to seminary and studied for the ministry, then started my doctorate, then I got ordained, and I did have a very, very wise mentor when I was first ordained, who was chaplain to one of the Oxford colleges where I was working, and he just kind of very gently but clearly guided me and kind of warned me off certain ways of doing things and nudged me towards other things. And I also had some very good role models around Oxford, clergy who I knew and loved and respected, who I'd heard preach, who I'd been to talk to pastorally, and who were able just more to show me than to tell me, really, how to do certain things and perhaps how not to do certain other things. And so I have been extremely fortunate. I've also had some role models in the theological world, people like my teacher, George Caird, and like Professor C.F.D. Mole, Charlie Mole in Cambridge, who I got to know, wonderful, godly, prayerful men who were great theologians, great biblical scholars, but also determinedly doing what they were doing for the church. So I've been very fortunate in seeing that. And, I mean, I've made many mistakes. I've made blunders and gone off spending time doing things that ultimately I probably should have pegged back from and so on. And I've learned by mistakes. And there's been many times when I've discovered that things have happened to me which have made me realize either my own weakness or my own inadequacy in certain ways, and I've had to either patch things up or whatever. So, it's been a rough ride sometimes, but an exhilarating one at other times. And I, as I say that, I can't fail to mention the fact that it's been a rough ride as well for my family. My wife has been amazingly long-suffering. You know, we've moved house a lot. We've gone from this to that. I've been in the public eye, and that's sometimes been quite difficult for the family. So, anyway.
Tell us about your children.
Oh, well, I have four children, two boys, two girls, 42, 40, 37, 35 right now, scattered around England, Durham, London, Bristol, Birmingham, and we see them reasonably frequently. They don't live as close as we'd like, but they have, each of them has one child, curiously, except for the youngest of ours, who has two. So we have five grandchildren, who are, of course, splendid by definition.
Sure, absolutely.
The most splendid grandchildren in all of the UK.
Absolutely.
So how old were you when you wrote your first book?
Good question. I co-authored one or two things early on. The first thing I really worked on myself was an edition of the works of the English reformer John Frith, who had not been edited since 1573, and I decided it was time somebody did that. But then the first book that I wrote that was purely me, I guess, was the Tyndale Commentary on Colossians, which came out in 86, I think. But I basically wrote it when I was 31, 32. I wrote my doctoral dissertation in my 20s, and I, of course, like all doctoral students, was very eager to publish my dissertation. My supervisor, George Caird, warned me against doing that, because what I had tried to do in my dissertation was really quite a large project, quite a big theme, really remaking Paul and Romans in ways that I hadn't fully appreciated just how much I was remaking. And he was right. I had to sort of put that down and do other things and gradually come back to it. And the bits of it have now turned into the larger Paul books that I've written.
And he probably told you you'd never make it as a writer.
Yeah. No. George himself is a brilliant writer, but he never commented much about my writing. And since he was critical of everything that he could be critical of, the fact that he wasn't critical of my writing in a negative way quite strong praise.
There you go.
What a guy!
I like hearing that you wrote your first book. You published your first book the year that I was born.
Oh, really?
That's good context for the whole thing.
So, Dr. Wright, we're getting toward the end of our time with you, and I've got a question for you. What do you think? I mean, you're a New Testament, one of the leading world-renowned New Testament scholars. What would you say? What do you think Paul would say to today's pastors? I mean, thinking about the small church pastors that are they're working in small communities, in small churches. Sometimes they wonder if they're ever going to be known. And they have to have a lot of patience, a lot of faithfulness, a lot of perseverance. You know, from your understanding of Paul and his writings and his heart, what would he say to today's pastors?
The question of being known, it's interesting that you put it like that. Paul says that we are unknown and yet well-known. And I think 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 3 onwards, would probably be what Paul would say. These are the signs of the apostles, that you are unknown and yet well-known, that you are dying and behold we live, that you are cast down but not forsaken, and all of that. And Paul was writing to the Corinthians, who wanted him to be a sort of a well-known figure. They wanted to have an apostle they could boast of. And many in ministry want to be the sort of people that their churches can be proud of. But actually, and, you know, naturally I say this as an old man and all the rest of it, but from the Pauline point of view, if you are loving your people, and if you are praying with and for them, and if you are teaching them faithfully from the scriptures, you will be known by the people who matter. In other words, by the people who love you in return and are grateful for your ministry. And for some people, that may be a core of 20 people who absolutely know that you are the one who they trust to lead them into the presence of God week by week and so on and so on. And for others, it may mean, wow, you know, let's move you to this church, or why didn't you apply for that job? But that's a snare and a delusion. And I would counsel young pastors and old pastors to soak themselves in 2 Corinthians, and particularly those middle chapters, from the end of chapter 2 through to the end of chapter 6, really, because that's Paul's agenda for what it means to be a pastor, to be a minister of reconciliation. And he's not looking for size of congregation or for success in worldly terms. As he says in 1 Corinthians, not many of you were doing anything in worldly terms. God chooses what is weak in the world's eyes to shame the strong. God chooses what is nothing in the world's eyes to shame those things that are. And I think God does exactly the same in the churches today. And I would also say, for goodness sake, lift up your eyes and look at the worldwide church. Look at what's happening in parts of the third world. Look at what's coming out of the Chinese church now, where they've been almost entirely underground for years, but now some of the writings from Chinese Christians who've lived with what it means to be a persecuted church for generations, they have now got things to teach us. And so we in the UK get stuck by thinking that Christianity is basically Britain plus a few friends, you know. And of course, we all know that's not true, but in the same way in America, people can get stuck in thinking mm-hmm. that Christianity is what it seems to be in America with a few others around the place. And actually, Christianity is a much bigger and more exciting and dramatic and dangerous thing than any of that. So I think to keep the Pauline focus, the 2 Corinthians focus, and to keep the global reach. But, you know, I was in a seminary a few years ago doing some lectures in a big Catholic seminary in Baltimore, St. Mary's Seminary, the one up on the hill there in Baltimore. And the president of the seminary, in the Q&A, he asked me from the chair, he said, what is your basic thing that you want to say to clergy as they're being trained? And I say, you need to learn how to pray, you need to learn how to read the Bible, and you need to learn how to love people. And if you're doing those 3 things, then let the chips fall where they will. And he said, from the chair, he said, that's exactly what I tell my young men. And I say, good, we're on the same page. Isn't that good?
That is good. Those are good moments. Well, Tom, it's been so great to talk to you. I hope after we end the recording here, you'll indulge me in one more question off the air.
Sure. It's very good to talk to you too. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been our golden episode. We're the 200 Churches podcast. This is episode 200. And we are honored, really honored that you were willing to talk to us, and such great content for small church pastors. I think they'll be very encouraged to hear your heart for the church those congregations.
You. Thank you so much, and we hope that you're going to be able to join us again.
Thank you very much. I hope so too.
Johnny, it's so funny. I think that Dr. Wright told us about how he walks around the campus of the University of St. Andrews there in Scotland, and he's just another prof.
Just a
walking
guy.
Up and down the sidewalks. Nobody even pays attention to him.
Just Dr. Wright out and about.
Yeah, and here we are, all of us who have been in seminary for the last 25 years have read his works.
Oh, my goodness.
We talked about him. He named off a lot of them.
Yep.
Very cool. And then you could, if you have a shelf that's just your N.T. Wright shelf.
There you go.
I think he's got, close to 70?
Something like that.
Theological works.
That's crazy, man.
I mean, his brain is, off the charts.
Yeah.
Unusual for anybody.
Yeah.
And here he was willing to talk with us. And the truth is, we can get him on again.
I think so.
But I think they wanted a certain number of votes from our audience before they would send him back to us.
So if you want N.T. Wright to come back on the podcast, what should we have him do?
They should tweet. Tweet it out.
Tweet us.
Tweet it out. Include at 200 Churches and whatever N.T. Wright's. I don't know.
I think it's N.T. Wright Online.
Is that it? At N.T. Wright Online?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just
get
just
some votes
out
there. Come on now. Bring him back.
So, Johnny, we have an offer. We have an offer on the table from N.T. Wright Online.
We have an offer. N.T. Wright Online, and he talked about it a little bit in this podcast. It's basically, if you take the writings of N.T. Wright on a book of the Bible and turn it into an online video course and put it out there for pastors. And he's doing this not to make money. And I want to put that out there because there's a lot of people trying to make a lot of money on the internet. As you know, Jeff and I are either not one of them or so bad at it that you didn't realize we were trying to do it. But for Tom, it's not about making a whole bunch of money. I think they run in the red on this. It's about helping pastors, and it's about helping people understand the Word of God better. And so they've given us a free course on Philemon. Or if you want a different course, you can have any of their courses for 50% off.
I think any number of their courses for 50% off.
Oh, really? Not just one.
Not just one.
It's like a coupon code for IC.
I'm saying that, but I'm not positive.
Well, we'll double check, but that's the deal. Free Philemon. So let me say this. Go get free Philemon, okay? It's free. It's N.T. Wright. It's in your house. This is like better than seminary level type education in some ways. And it's for free. Go get your free Philemon. Go to 200churches.com, episode 200, and we'll have links to the NT Wright online, the page for 200 Churches, where you can get that Philemon course, or you can get 50% off his other courses. Take advantage of this. I mean, if you've never read NT Wright, okay, if he was kind of a new person to you today, this is your opportunity to dig in. Without buying books, you know, you'll want to buy the books when you're done, but without buying his books, without getting into all of that kind of stuff, this is a zero financial obligation opportunity to grow yourself as a pastor and to hear from one of the preeminent New Testament scholars alive. I mean, that's not an over-exaggeration. That's what we're talking about here. So get that Philemon course.
And what we're working on with NT Wright Online is to make it so that you as a pastor can have maybe a group or a class in your church that wants to work through a book of the Bible that NT Wright has already done a video course on.
Yeah.
Both a video course as well as notes that are online, or you can print them out.
Yes.
And you can go through this Bible study with your people, and you could watch the video all together as a group, or you can each separately watch the video at home and then come and study it together. Either way, you'll all in the class have access to the same course at a very, very reasonable price.
Yeah.
And NT Wright Online wants to be able to do that, especially for pastors of mm-hmm. smaller churches, especially for small churches with limited resources. So we're working on that with them, and that's gonna probably happen very soon, and we will let you know when that happens. But for now, that Philemon course and any other NT Wright Online course you want for 50% off.
Yeah, the last thing I'm going to say is, if you don't know this, at the end of every episode, there's some outtakes. Actually, the last one, there was no outtakes, but usually, at the end of every episode, there's outtakes. Stick around for the NT Wright outtakes. Because it's more information, it's more content, and then you just get to see the human side of this person who maybe you've read so much of or learned so much from, and it's fun. When we got done, he was going to just eat dinner with his wife. It seems so domestic. It seems so normal. It's like, of course, NT Wright eats dinner with his wife, but it was just funny. Like, he was like, he dropped all of that knowledge and then was just like, oh, I gotta step off to dinner with my wife. Like,
I think he said, I smell a dinner from the other room.
Yeah, exactly. Like, okay, man, that's fantastic. So stick around for the outtakes after this episode.
Well, that's 200, Johnny. I don't know.
That's it, man.
I think we wrap it up here.
Well, why go on? It's
over with. So start back at episode one. You poor sucker.
Oh, my goodness.
No, I have a feeling that there'll be a 201.
And we won't even let it be a letdown.
I guess you'll have to wait until next week, because who's going to be on it?
No one knows.
Nobody knows. Hey, thanks for listening to episode 200 of the 200 Churches Podcast.
We hope you've been encouraged and inspired by this episode of the 200 Churches Podcast. If you haven't already, subscribe at 200churches.com and receive the guy's free PDF download called Our 7 Favorite Ministry Resources. You can count on us to be back next Wednesday with another brand new, shiny episode just for you. Until then, may God bless you as you lead and love the people in your 200 church.
I read all sorts of people. I'm very eclectic. I just grab things. I see books and scoop them up and read them as quick as I can, because life is short and books are long. Obviously, I read my dear friend Richard Hayes. Everyone should read Richard Hayes. He's one of the finest American biblical scholars there's ever been. But my friend and colleague who died in Cambridge, his predecessor in my present chair, Richard Borkum, some wonderful, wonderful stuff that Richard's written. Miroslav Volf in Yale,
sure.
Great,
yeah.
a really amazing theologian. So there's plenty going on out there.
Tom, I hope that you get a good night's sleep tonight. You deserve it.
So do I. I'm actually about to go, and I hope I'm about to go and have supper. I think my wife has just been cooking something.
Well, I'm thankful that she lets you talk to us for this long. It's been really, really a pleasure. It really has.
Great. Thanks, guys. I'm sorry the Skype didn't work.
Hey, this is phenomenal.
This sounds great.
We had a great contact here.
Super. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.